Hello and welcome to the Psycho Media Podcast. I am Timothy Swan, and I totally did not forget that that is the second line.
And I'm Ben Fell, and I totally remembered my line, and together we are hoping to discuss the funny side of psychology. Hoping being the operative term this week, given that we have had a few technical glitches trying to get this thing sorted out.
Yes, we got distracted by chanting, so we were hypnotized for a bit, and then there were some more mundane technical problems. Have you been letting dragons eat your cables?
It's entirely likely that the dragons in that may or may not have been filling my life in the last few days may have infected my computer with horrible dragon viruses.
I think I can hear some crackling flames in the background, in fact, yeah, of your sound feed.
They may be going at my wireless router. I like the way that you casually throw in the word, the fact that we've been doing some chanting. I thought you were going to elaborate on it, but it's entirely appropriate, you know.
No, I'm pretty sure it's all recorded, so I'm pretty sure it's going in a Franken podcast.
Excellent.
We could have a chanting special. What was the one I was going to do? Oh, I was going to do the one from Battlestar Galactica. Although I wanted to look up the words, but that isn't a fantasy chant. That's a Hindu chant sung by someone who I'm only a couple of degrees disconnected from, thanks to the Overthinking It podcast.
We should try and find a study on the effects of chanting to give us an excuse to do lots of chanting.
Oh, I bet there is. There's stuff on monks,
almost
both
certainly
Buddhist and Christian, and they both love chants. I read a whole book on it.
Well, there's a lot of stuff on meditation. A friend of mine on my master's course was trying to get a study off the ground in which he went into prisons and taught meditation to prisoners. But it turned out the prisons didn't want their prisoners to be calmer and more relaxed.
Really?
Something
fascinating.
Along those lines.
criminal psychology is very interesting. If I learned anything about prison, it's one of the worst ideas ever conceived in human history. But let's not get political. Let's talk about ourselves. Feedback!
Hooray! Ego stoking, as it's also known.
I thought it sounded like you said ego smoking. I'm just picturing Freud with his cigar. What does super ego go smoking look like?
I'd be like a long cigarillo type thing.
No, it doesn't. A super ego is disciplined enough not to be addicted to smoking. I feel I'm judged.
I prefer the idea of one with a pipe, but that's just
actually, yes, pipe.
Possibly a bubble pipe.
And the id?
I think the id is just like frantically rubbing cocaine into its gums.
Okay, I was thinking of it with a joint because of kind of the munchies and the giggling and the rest of it. The id, I think of the id as being quite childish in a way, that the id is the one that laughs at the dirty jokes. I feel we're being very rude. We're talking about some rather blue material today. So, let's talk about all feedback.
Let's do that. Before feedback, I would like to apologise for the fact that, once again, the second time in the ridiculously short life of this podcast, I am ill, which I'm very annoyed about. So I apologise for the slightly nasal voice, inability to pronounce B's or D's, or whichever it is that I'm supposed to not be able to pronounce. And the fact
B's
that I've done a basically cursory level of preparation for this week's podcast.
Oh, don't say that.
As a result of a conflation of factors which we will talk about later.
Okay, yeah. You're sounding a bit like that dragon is really going at your hearth there. I don't know why that might be. Is your illness, has it grown your nose so it's touching your microphone or something?
I don't think so. I can try moving the microphone away. Possibly that's better.
Move the mic away to breathe. Right, feedback. That's what I said. We had a pretty good message from Amanda this week. I'm not going to read it all out because it's long. But executive summary was that as Amanda was listening to last week's episode, she decided to draw some random images based on what we were talking about.
That seems a very bad idea to me, but it seemed to work out quite well.
Including an octopus about 5 minutes before we actually started talking about Doc Ock in the previous. So she's become a psychic drawer, is it Isaac in Season 1 of Heroes? I miss when, there were American TV shows that I watched
Heroes
obsessively
is good, is basically
over. Yeah, pretty much. And she confirms that she uses Tetris in a minor way when she's had an argument with her boyfriend.
I'm not sure that was quite the vibe that we were going for. I mentioned this particular piece of feedback to the multiple aforementioned girlfriend. Not the multiple girlfriends.
I was going to say, one that's is been there mentioned something you're not telling times. Me?
Already, like, we're what, 1 minute in and I'm already in trouble. Anyway, she is somewhat competitive. it has a slight competitive streak in her, which means that she doesn't get sued by Tetris. She gets enraged and hyper-competitive and, in some cases, violent by her account.
Oh, that's a good point. What do you do to deal with the trauma of having lost the championship Tetris match?
Play some... Oh, wait. No!
Actually, it's anything that involves a certain level of cognitive demand. Which is actually the way Amanda says she uses it. So well done, Amanda. You've figured it out. I spoke to another guy who listens to my show, who I think I know listens to my... I forget sometimes, you know, the audience. It was in real life, and I was sitting by a bank of Macs. And he said, oh, you know, it must be pretty familiar for you, sitting by a bank of Macs. And I was like, no, not really. He's like, oh, but your podcast, it must be done on Mac. I said, no, just good old Windows PCs and Skype. At that point, I was feeling very optimistic about the technology we use. But
matters have changed. What? 20 minutes.
He expressed his admiration, as others have done, for our sound quality, which is ironic this week, and how it does sound like we're recording with a degree of rapport and sound quality from being in the same room / studio, etc. So,
I think we're in the same mental room, which may be the result of the rapport. I think
this room with a lot
may be somewhat stilted. Well, yeah, the rapport may be somewhat stilted because I'm hearing maybe 70% of what Tim is saying. So it's very, my responses are very much a case of extrapolation and prediction.
Well, you're doing very well so far, I imagine.
Yes, that, I agree.
You're good at using a kind of heuristic algorithm to fill in the gaps.
I have a very good Tim algorithm. I felt there was a pun in there, but there wasn't. Anyway, we should move on from the feedback.
Well, no. One last thing is that I did my semi-regular look at our iTunes page thing, which is harder than it looks. And we do have another iTunes comment, and I feel it's good to highlight the iTunes comments because you should all do it in order to spread the good news of a funny podcast, you know, that unique item on the internet.
We are literally the only funny podcast on the internet.
Yeah. I listen to so many unfunny ones the whole time by supposed professionals, and I sit there thinking, why am I not listening to Psycho Media? I don't. Even I don't go that far yet. Anyway, so This Is Not My Nickname said, a Freuding good show. The presenters, Ben Fell and Timothy Swan, which he puts your name first. I'd say that's a sign of obsessive compulsive disorder, or as Chris Addison calls it, compulsive disorder obsessive, because then it's an alphabetical order. This bit is actually, I love this. The presenters have a good rapport. Oh, we were just talking about that. Or seem to. I suppose they might secretly hate each other. And
damn it, they finally found us out.
We are in fact mortal enemies. We're mortal enemies in the same way as two of the guys we're going to be talking about this week. That will spend our whole lives
become a more disturbed prospect when we get later in the show.
Yes, I thought that through and I went with it anyway. No, Ben doesn't hate me unless I start talking about Greek letters. Which is funny if you've heard the bits of the podcast that
very
didn't successfully record.
You're very lucky there, Tim, because I had to mute my mic and blow my nose at the exact moment you mentioned the word that I think you mentioned.
Rage so sneeze.
You have avoided death for another 5 minutes or so.
Anyway, and they generate consistently entertaining banter. Now, the word banter has become devalued, and I feel we should reclaim it, if only to improve the value of that compliment. The conceit of the show discussing psychology experiments is quite interesting and very well executed. The episodes are themed.
I found that
Sorry, I keep talking.
Before you skipped the end, I have found personally that the word banter has had a lot of life reinvigorated into it by the invention of one of my friends of the Norse god Bantir, who is invoked before all heavy drinking sessions and lash. And this adds a sort of a vague Nordic theme to any time you're being kind of upper middle class and leery and using the term banter excessively.
I know that I'm still technically in the middle of a paragraph, but you used to have a color-coded banter system, if I recall.
Oh, yeah, we did. Yeah, I don't want to go into the details on it.
No, I quite...
may prove incriminating.
Wasn't it just like there was... I don't even think there was a green level. It was
amber, red and black.
Black was for stuff that was actively illegal to even discuss, I believe. Have I misremembered?
No, that's pretty much accurate. For that reason, yes. If we could move on to this nice piece of feedback.
So yes, he said, the episodes are themed and give a thoroughly amusing look at this bizarre world of ours. Psychomedia is well worth downloading, but may prove to be addicting. So that's
excellent.
Good. We'll have to do an episode on addiction. I'm sure there's funny stuff. We stimulate your dopamine.
Yeah, that's great.
With our fingers.
That was what we were aiming for with our TMS gun of the internet.
Okay,
referencing to minor points in previous podcasts. That's what we do.
That's how we make great podcasts. Richard Herring made a career out of it in the last 5 years.
Anyway, yes, so I think that is all the feedback, given that you said that was the last piece. So what have you done this week, Tim?
What have I done this week? Okay, let's look at the order in which I need to say these things. Because I am a professional podcaster in the sense that I am a hugely amateurish podcaster, but I went on the Dissecting Worlds Friends of the Podcast to talk about the Chronicles of Narnia with my extensive 13 A4 pages of notes and research.
Wow. That does sound more like professional than it probably was.
Yeah, I only have, how many pages of notes for today? Only 3 pages.
I have notes.
Yeah, exactly. We do actually every week because apparently it's more difficult if you don't. I had a great time on the show. They're both very clever people to work with. We had some fun. We talked about some interesting things, the history of the books, their contrast with Philip Pullman and how... angry he is, which is very, very much me biting the hand that feeds, given that Philip Pullman once said he liked, I mean, amongst a group of other short stories, one of my short stories as being capably well written or something like that.
High praise.
I know, so I
decided to throw it back in his face and go,
you have, yeah, consistently entertaining banter as well. It's like a level flat thing, never dipping.
And thus, highly inaccurate.
Yeah, I'll put a link in the show notes.
I feel
for those of you who haven't had it thrown at you by my Twitter, etc.
I feel that our banter is very much a sine wave. Sorry, I've been doing a lot of Fourier analysis in my MRI classes recently. That sounded funnier in my mind, but that's possibly due to the cold.
I think the interaction between two people should never really be described as a sine wave.
Yeah, you may be right there. As long as physical motion is not involved.
I have to step back from this, and I will step back from this to the safe ground of Ben. Did you watch a film this week?
You got in there just in time.
I think we got away with it.
I sort of watched a film this week. I started watching the new Conan the Barbarian film, got about 20 minutes in, and then was utterly bored. Even the presence of Ron Perlman, who is... we were trying to work this out before the show. There was an article in Empire, the film magazine a while ago, about actors who, by the very dint of their presence, add a certain percentage to any of the review score of any film they're in. Nathan Fillion was definitely one of them. It was something awkward, like 12%, and we couldn't...
Oh, I thought you meant money score.
Oh, no.
Also, when you read Empire magazine, my subscription is to a very different Empire magazine.
Yes. Anyway, so I feel that Ron Perlman is one of these people because I will watch anything that has Ron Perlman in just because it's got Ron Perlman in. Unfortunately, he died at about the 15-minute mark, spoilers, and subsequent to that, it went downhill rapidly. So, I sort of watched a film this week. What I've spent most of my time this week doing is playing, well, partly waiting for, and partly thinking about, but mostly playing Elder Scrolls Skyrim, which came out a few days ago, and is delicious and wonderful. It took a really, really long time to arrive. It said it had been dispatched, and I got all excited because it was dispatched like 2 days before the release date, and I was like, wow, I'm making it early. And then on the release date, it didn't arrive until like 6 o'clock in the evening, at which point...
Who was that delivery guy?
It was supposed to be delivered by Royal Mail, right? You're getting it.
Oh, dear.
Supposed to be delivered by Royal Mail, but Amazon said some... like couriers will not deliver until up until 9 o'clock in the evening. So if you're going to complain, you should wait until after 9 o'clock. I think this is a cunning ploy to stop them actually having to field the call. It got to about 6 o'clock and I was like, well, it's definitely not coming. And then it turned up and I made loud noises. But the point of this is, in the time that I was waiting for it to turn up, I obviously couldn't think about anything else. So took it upon myself to A, learn to play the theme tune on guitar, and B, learn all the lyrics to the theme tune in the like made up dragon language that they have. So I have reached new heights of nerdery and many levels this week.
Well, well done. I think you tweeted during the week using your Twitter account.
Yes.
Well, technically the podcast Twitter account, but sort of yours as well.
That I have hijacked for personal use.
Oh, so personal.
Yeah.
You've been using it to network with people on the internet. No, that's at Team Psycho Media, by the way,
that's
guys.
Team
Psycho. Do follow it, because otherwise... Ben will be sad. If he can't get in like 4 years as many followers as I have, princely sum of 100 and something, he will, I don't know.
So I'll
hit me
if you don't follow me
in the head with an axe like Christian Bale in American Psycho.
In four years I'll get back to you as to whether I'm sad or not.
It's a longitudinal study. Okay, so yeah, you were saying that you were working, and also at the time that I was working,
yeah,
because I finally started my new job. And obviously I can't talk very much about it on account of that is a very hollow clap. What is it called? Confidentiality.
Oh yeah,
it's so secret I can't even remember what it's called. So I can't say much about it. Suffice to say that my first day was, you know, pretty straightforward. But there were some scary amounts of responsibility for someone like me who doesn't quite feel ready to be responsible for anything. But for the most part, it was a languid walk around a circular path with a nice lunch at the end. Quite a nice way to, you know, fulfill your life's ambitions and get paid for doing a job.
Up until the nice lunch, that was sounding like some kind of Zen proverb or like metaphor. I mean, maybe it is still with the nice lunch. Life is a circular path, preferably with a nice lunch.
I saw someone I know on Facebook ask the question to someone who is working in kind of administration, what is the sound of one email clapping?
I like that. I like that. That's much.
Pretty good. Let's see if Ramachandran can solve it.
Well, he's solved all the others, so that,
yeah.
Excellent. Someone should just send him like a book of Zen koans and... like with a sheet of notepaper attached.
See how many he can solve in an hour.
With forwards to the Dalai Lama written on it.
Yeah, well, the Dalai Lama, as I was saying earlier, although I can't remember whether it was in the podcast, out of the podcast, it's all weird now, Ben. I don't understand.
So much of your life is spent in podcasts.
I wrote a psychology book that was co-authored. I wrote? No. Oh my goodness, my brain is such an absurd fantasist. I read a psychology book that was co-authored with the Dalai Lama. I haven't written one yet, and I'm unlikely to. Anyway, thinking of things that go round in a circle...
Uh-oh, do I hear a belaboured segue coming on?
Belaboured segue!
Belaboured segue!
We are talking about mental imagery, which for some reason is dominated by things going round in a circle, like arguments.
And the course of this podcast, probably. So yeah, mental imagery. This was nominally my choice for the topic, because it's something I possibly remember slightly more about than Tim, although I think we both studied it the same degree. I'm working towards a definition, which is a really nice concrete thing to aim for. So anyway, psychologically speaking, mental imagery was defined by a guy called Coslin, who will come up much later, as seeing in the absence of the appropriate immediate sensory input. So, I mean, that already it makes it very clear that it is kind of, yeah, seeing with your mind's eye. It's most commonly referred to in the visual domain, seeing with the mind's eye. But at least hypothetically, there should be other kinds, such as hearing with the mind's ear, smelling with the mind's nose, and feeling with the mind's hand, which is a direct quote from our lecture notes. And I'm not quite sure why I find it, the idea of feeling with the mind's hand or smelling with the mind's nose, so funny.
I just spent a little while trying to taste with the mind's the mind's tongue. Quite difficult.
Having more difficulty with speaking with the mind's tongue.
Speaking with the mind's tongue. Oh, that's what I keep forgetting to do, is to make it just speak with the body's tongue. My internal monologue is coming up with some great podcast ideas.
If only there was some way of like plugging it in. Maybe it could be the basis of a really bad neurology joke. My mind's got no nose.
How does he smell?
Using propositional statements, which is a joke that would have been funny at the end of the podcast.
Yeah, exactly. Listen again, and when you get to this bit, I was going to say with the G/01. It's not really a joke.
Not really.
Or a statement of fact.
It's the fine line we tread.
Yeah, and it is a fine line. So mental imagery, you've defined it as seeing with the mind's eye. I think a lot of people experience mental imagery as daydreaming and the rest of it, or trying to imagine something deliberately. But most of the study on that hasn't really been as complex as most people's imaginations are. So, for example, one of the first studies, this is totally not in the notes, but I remember it now, is imagine a banana on a completely black wall. Now, when I imagine things, I don't tend to imagine things in isolation. You imagine a scene. I don't tend to just imagine a banana. I don't know. Maybe I just don't like bananas enough. And actually what they found is if you projected a banana onto the wall where you told them to imagine a banana, they didn't think it was really there. They just thought it was their mental image. Whereas
The really cool thing about that particular study, I think, was that when you ask someone to imagine a banana, guys at home, you can try this now. Imagine a banana on a black wall. I imagine that you will be imagining that banana in the standard upright orientation that most bananas are traditionally depicted in. However, what apparently they found in this study was that if you project very faintly a banana onto the black wall that the person's looking at, and you project the banana in the horizontal or smiley face position,
that's how then, I'm picturing it,
people will kind of become then biased towards saying that they see it in the smiley face position, but not report the fact that they can see anything on the wall, which is kind of cool.
So yeah, mental imagery has actually been studied for over 100 years, but it really came into its own in the 70s for some reason. It's kind of these weird ones. We do all these things and it's like the first studies of attention really came about in the 50s. Why then? Why was the 50s everyone into attention?
I think I can come up with one possible suggestion for why mental imagery might have been of interest in the 70s.
Is it because they just got out of the 60s?
Possibly. And they wanted to know what the hell was going on.
I thought for the 50s, it's just like one of the first guys had the realization, or at least the thought experiment, at a cocktail party. And if you've learned anything from watching Mad Men, there's a lot of cocktail parties for sophisticated intellectuals to go to. So that's when it came about. Whereas in the 40s, it was all rationing and there wasn't enough, you know, gin to make good cocktails.
That is probably true.
But it's probably not true. I bet the alcohol was one of the things that did survive quite strongly.
Mental rotation has been mental imagery has been studied a lot of ways, but I've just given the game away as to one of the chief ways that it's people that psychologists have tried to pin it down experimentally.
Yes, mental rotation, which
is not going really, really, really fast round and round about so much that it's crazy.
Let's see how many times we can misuse the different definitions of the word mental. during this podcast. I'm going to think that it's going to be many. But yeah, mental imagery has been dominated by mental rotation, really. And I think it's primarily down to one study, and that's the study of Shepard and Metzler in 1971. Actually, I think that's a bit of a shame, because as I've said, of all the things I spend my time imagining, something spinning around is not usually one of them. And my theory on this is that Shepard and Metzler just love windmills. That's my theory. So step one...
It's like a latter-day Don Quixote in reverse. Plus psychology.
Which, somewhat, you're distancing it from the original concept so far as to be a meaningless comparison.
Odd that.
I'm sure Cervantes would approve. Anyway, so step one of mental imagery is to summon an imaginary image. But once you've summoned it, actually...
Cost seven mental image. Sorry, too much Skyrim. Much too much Skyrim.
Well, what is the MP cost of...
I don't know. I don't play a wizard.
But yeah, MP kind of mental... Anyway, no, we're not getting distracted just because we've spent our whole weeks distracted. Anyway, yeah, step two is to mess with it, or the technical term image transformation, because a mental image isn't that much use on its own if it's just a static image. And so the way they tested this, or, you know, investigated, I suppose, was they'd show pairs of images of the same 3D figure at different degrees of rotation, and they had their participants decide whether they were the same or different, usually by a mirror flip, because you can't get back to the original of a mirror flipped object by rotation. That's some geometric rule. And so in order to figure out whether they were the same or different, you had to rotate the second one to the point where it would be lined up with the first one. And then if it was the same, you'd kind of mentally see that it was the same. And if it wasn't, you'd mentally see that it wasn't. So you had to, in your mind, take an image that you could see and turn it. Yeah, I'm going to include an image of Shepard just to get you in the 70s mood. He has the look of a man who could only exist in the 70s. And in fact, at the moment, I am just picturing his moustache rotating around and around and around. So
it matches with Metzler's.
You can...
And then they lock.
Oh, yeah, I'm trying to remember if Metzler was a man or a woman. Because... I don't know. Metzler is the shadowy figure. But no, the pictures weren't pictures of mustaches. They were pictures of 3D shapes made from cubes. And the finding that they discovered is actually quite stunning. They found that the response times of the participants were higher the greater the amount of rotation that had to be done. They couldn't just switch the image from, you know, 60 degrees to 0 degrees or 120 degrees to 0 degrees. They had to move it around in their minds at a set speed, just as they would have to do if they had a physical object in front of them. That the laws of Newtonian physics still applied inside their heads.
And it wasn't just that, say, there was a sort of a processing limit on what their mental imagery could do. The fact was that they calculated the speed at which people were rotating objects. And it was about the speed that you would rotate an object if you were holding it, which is kind of cool.
Yeah, I mean, so that is pretty cool. So what they suggested was that mental imagery is analogical to reality and perception. And that's why they chose to call it that. I don't quite know, but that's their position. It's known as the analogical position. I'm about to do something that's going to make me shudder. But yes, a fellow called Rock... who would enter any academic journal by asking if you could smell what Alvin Rock was cooking, or in this case, rotating.
Alvin?
I'm pretty sure he was called
really?
Alvin.
That's just like, the name's Rock. Well, this guy's cool. This guy is serious. This guy knows what's about. Alvin Rock. Oh, no.
Alvin, Simon, and Theodore. So Rock took quite strongly against this analogical position for no adequately explored reason. And he said that what was going on was not the image moving, just as if you were seeing the image move, but a reassignment of axes. So what you were doing was you had all the data about this mental image in your head, and you just had to change some of the data values. And the more that one of these data values had to change,
the more difficult it was. So basically, Rock is a bit like Cypher reading the Matrix. But instead of blonde, brunette, redhead, he's like 60 degrees, 90 degrees, 180 degrees, which is a bit sad for him. But I'm thinking of being sad for him. Basically, it took longer to rotate further because it was this minor shift in axes for a smaller number of degrees, where it was reversing the polarity for 180 degrees, because Rock was apparently a Doctor Who nerd, possibly. But who uses that phrase without being one?
Exactly.
And in order to disprove Shepard and Metzler, he made his own task of rotating pictures based on 3D models. But he made the 3D models, instead of out of cubes, he made them out of pipe cleaners. And the participants couldn't do it because it was absolutely an impossible task. those who could even do it a little bit tend to focus on key features that you could figure out how they would rotate. And the thing about this is it doesn't really prove or disprove his hypothesis on how rotation was being achieved. It doesn't prove that it has to be propositional, which is his position, not, you know, Cypher data, but propositional.
All that that study really proves is that it's really hard to rotate pipe cleaners, whatever method you use to do it.
Yeah, pretty much. And besides, Cooper, an ally of Shepard's, had already come up with something quite clever. She'd got people to imagine rotating the first object in their minds and then shown the second object, and she knew the speed at which they were going to be rotating them in their minds, and she could see the response times based on how far it would have gotten. So let me explain it clearly in a different way. If you know the speed of rotation, which is about 60 degrees per second, then if you show an image that has been rotated 90 degrees at 1.5 seconds of the task, the answer will practically be instant, because in their heads they will have already rotated it 90 degrees.
Which is, yeah, kind of nice, strong evidence for that position.
I mean, it still doesn't really prove it's analogical, or prove it's propositional, but it is. It does prove that it follows a pretty set speed. And that speed kind of is a constant, and you can make predictions based on it. But clearly, you need to go deeper. You need to look at some of the more weird things that go beyond this finding.
So that was a neat segue there. One of the particularly interesting things about this strange property of human mental rotation is that it seems to be, as cued by that sentence, specific to humans. Other animals seem to be able to do mental rotation, but they don't do it in the same way. So there's a study by Hollard and Delius in 1982 called Rotational Invariance in Visual Pattern Recognition by Pigeons and Humans. And this was a major paper. It was published in Science. And basically what they found was, in terms of accuracy, when humans and pigeons are set against each other, the pigeons do roughly as well as the humans in accurately judging whether two forms are the same or different. Obviously, the humans just had to say, whereas the pigeons, like, pecked a thing to get some food.
Yeah, they get a lot more rewards, do animals, doing these tasks.
Significantly more. However, pigeons were, overall, much, much faster than humans at making these judgments. And what Hollard and Delius found when they analysed the data was that whereas humans show this linear relationship between the degree of rotation that they have to perform mentally and the time it takes them to respond, pigeons have no difference. They do the same speed every time, and that speed is quite fast. So it would seem that pigeons don't have this this sort of physical, analogical form of mental imagery. Now, Hollard and Delius have a suggestion as to why this might be. They reckon that it's because the explanation they give, I didn't quite follow. They said that humans operate in human vision operates in the kind of the frontal plane, as in things happen in front of you, and therefore you have to be sensitive to things like gravity and how things will rotate with gravity, whereas for pigeons, vision operates in the horizontal plane primarily, and therefore they don't need to be concerned with that stuff. I think basically what they're saying is humans kind of stand upright on the ground and pigeons tend to fly around a lot.
Okay, it's not to do with the whole predator-prey thing, because if you think about the visual fields, animals with eyes on the sides of their head have different visual fields to animals that are on the front of their head. So what you would expect from their prediction is if you tested, I don't know, an owl, because its eyes are facing forward, it would show the same mental rotation effects as humans.
That would be an interesting hypothesis. The really interesting thing about this study is that there's lots of possible explanations for why it happens, none of which, it must be said, tell you very much about mental imagery, but are all very interesting. They tell you a lot about animals. And that is a good suggestion, and easily testable.
If you've got a few owls,
which lots of psychologists do, they're used a lot in hearing research. I could tell you very interesting things about the auditory system of the owl, which is very cool, but I'm not going to. I'm gonna save it for another time.
Sure.
What I thought it might be was that because humans are used to manual manipulation of novel objects, which I giggled when I was writing, they are used to exploring things based on their kind of physical properties and the properties of the physical world. So we tend to, if we, like as babies, if we encounter a novel object, once we get past biting it, we tend to explore it with our hands. Whereas pigeons, not possessing hands, at least not the wild ones, the ones in the zoology department next door, maybe, I don't know. They tend to... Well, if the specimens of pigeons that live outside my window are anything to go by, they tend to explore novel objects by flying into them really fast and smashing their faces into them until they pass out, which might explain why maybe mental rotation isn't really needed for that. But you can see how...
Ben, I think I found out something about myself. I think I'm a pigeon.
Well, we worked out a couple of weeks ago that you have Broca's aphasia, so we're gradually building up a detailed...
I don't remember that.
Building up a detailed psychological profile of you. So you're a pigeon with Broca's aphasia.
Is that even possible?
I don't know. I mean, they do make kind of repetitive, stereotyped utterances, and they don't have a great command of grammar. But then I don't know many Broca's aphasics that repeatedly bang their faces into windows.
Well, you can get frustrated some days. But it is interesting that human-animal contrast.
Yeah. But in terms of the development of the field, it's very interesting, but not necessarily particularly significant. What is like the reason for choosing this particular topic, apart from the fact that it has pigeons in it, was that, like our very first podcast about Messrs. Buckley and Squire, or as I think they should henceforth be known, Squuckley. mental imagery seems to be a ridiculously polarizing subject, to the extent that it causes vitriolic rage and hatred on proponents of different theories for it. And the kind of the main battleground of this has been fought over the last sort of 15 years between two chief theories of how mental imagery works in general. Now, these kind of relate to the analogical versus the propositional theories that Tim was talking about, which was the Rock versus Shepherd and Metzler positions. But they've kind of developed to be more sort of general theories of how mental imagery works.
Hey Ben, can we violently disagree on which order we're doing stuff in the podcast?
We can. Have I made a boo-boo? Or are you going to violently disagree with me now?
I'll violently disagree and say that before you talk about Koslin and Polishin, because that amount of whys really has to be sent to the end of the podcast.
It does.
I should talk about Wollschläger, because his research comes out of the pigeon stuff.
Oh, what about Wollschläger? Are you going to talk about him too?
Yeah. Wollschläger, right?
Which one?
No, the original Wollschläger, not his clone, not his Doppel-Wollschläger-Ganger.
Because I do need to clear this up. You do know that there are two Wollschlägers.
I'm aware. Aren't they, are they husband and wife, or are they brothers?
I don't know, but they both have the initial A, which makes it even more confusing.
Anton and Antonin Wollschläger. Why they would have French first names and German surnames, who knows?
Anyway, so I have massively jumped the gun because Tim left too long a pause. after the I'd finished talking about pigeons. As mentioned previously, this is a shoddily prepared podcast.
I'm not going to edit it back together. We're just going to violently disagree for 30 years in academic print about whether Wollschläger or Koslin and Polishin take precedence in the order.
Yeah, let's do that.
You have a nihilistic hypothesis of our timeline.
Your theory is grotesque.
Your face is grotesque.
Your mum's grotesque.
Take that back. She might listen to this one day.
Your mum is lovely. I've never met her, and she is neither grotesque nor nihilistic. Hello, Tim's mum.
Yeah, I think my dad has just set up her iPod to receive my podcast, so whether she'll listen to them, who knows. Anyway, Wollschläger. Right, so basically, because there was this interest in why there might be the human relation of manipulating novel objects to mental imagery, a fellow called Parsons had this idea to look at some more realistic shapes. And so what he used were left or right hands in a very similar task to the shepherd task. And so at various angles, you ask, is this a left hand or a right hand? And what you're essentially doing is you have to rotate it to being face up, because then you can tell by the position of the thumb whether it's a left hand or a right hand.
It actually makes perfect sense to you that use this task in an evolutionary context, because it was probably developed apparently during the Roman Empire by gladiators who needed to be able to very quickly determine the orientation of a thumb.
Wow, you really do want to lose our classicists. The way the thumbs went, yeah, misunderstood classics jokes. The way the thumbs went in Rome is either out and upwards or tucked into the fingers. There was no up or down.
Well, don't I feel silly?
Yeah. Actually, no, it's not established and concluded, because it's really hard to find out which way thumbs went. But the scholarly consensus is that it was like sheath your sword or thrust your sword rather than yay or nay.
Okay. I apologize for the inaccurate interruption.
Yeah. So you should. No, but basically, what it showed was delays in time for rotations of hands that would not be physically possible. So as I've been doing this, I've been rotating my right hand, and there is a number of degrees that are possible physically, but then there's about a 90 degree set that isn't possible. And so while this might suggest that Shepherd and Cooper aren't spot on in their linear progression, what it actually supports is that the imagination doesn't just follow the rules of physics, but of the physical universe.
Hmm.
And in a way, that's a bit disappointing. But if you think back to your fantasies and your dreams, they might break what's psychologically possible, but have you ever defied the physical universe in them? The best example I could think of when I reflected on this deeply, went through my dream journal and my fantasy journal, was teleportation, right? Which we all know is common in dreams, except it's not really teleportation. It's more like extremely cut scene transitions, as I may do to this podcast to make it seem like we knew what we're doing.
Which makes sense, because I wonder if that kind of dream has increased dramatically since the invention of television.
Or the release of Inception. But you might wonder if actually this research is that useful or not. Actually, I think, not this research, sorry, this only being able to imagine in physical limitations, I'm inclined towards useful, because we use mental imagery to think things through, to plan our actions, to rather than risking ourselves and actually just doing something without thinking. And if we had to impose the proper laws of physics kind of consciously, then things might be a bit more difficult. I mean, it's no good me picturing shooting an arrow at the right elevation to hit a target if I also have to consciously implement gravity properly. Because if I forget, then time contraction occurs and I've shot a million arrows into the target and turned into a skeleton. That's an Einstein joke. A very carefully researched one as well.
I'm not laughing because I get it. I'm laughing because you made it.
Well, if that's good enough for you, then hopefully it's good enough for our listeners. I would explain it, basically.
But we haven't got time.
Oh, no. Let's wait. What do we have to do? We have to go into a heavier gravity field, and then we will have enough time. Because of time dilation.
Competition. What? Anyone who wishes to explain Tim's ridiculous physics joke, please write in and tell us what it means. Tell me what it means. Tell me on Twitter what Tim's joke means, because I have no idea.
Yeah. Send a postcard across the event horizon of a black hole. Actually, no, that wouldn't work, because information can't escape a black
hole. Tim!
Sorry. I could put in the kind of...
Volschlager and Volschlager. Okay. A very interesting study in 1998 and 2000. Why don't you tell us about it?
Okay, what basically this showed, this Parsons thing that set up the Volschlager stuff, was that mental imagery has all of these inputs from other parts of the brain. That it's not just using the perceptual system or whatever to imagine anything, but it actually has inputs from example, the motor system that tells you where you can move your hands and where you can't, hopefully, if you trust yours. And neuroimaging by Parsons backs this up. But Volschlager, which I looked it up, and it means something like well hitter or something like whole... No. Not well... I can't remember what it was.
I thought it meant a kind of alcoholic beverage constructed by fermenting small rodents.
Schlager means all sorts of things like bat and racket. I'm trying to remember what the word...
It's Bat the Rat. It's Bat the Rat.
Bat the Rat.
Popular fairground game in, like, I don't know, rural German villages where you have to hit a small wooden rat with a stick. Except in Germany, it's Schlag the Vole.
Not Schlag Devil, Schlag the Vol.
Yeah.
Anyway, so what he wanted to see was whether this motor system and mental rotation actually fed back into perception. Because we assume, naively, that perception is based on reality, what's actually there. Whereas mental imagery is a construction based on the rules we've learned and the rest of it. Volschlager showed participants that a circle of lights that was kind of ambiguous into the direction it was going, which is what happens when you have that kind of limited amount of information. And then he had them plan movements. First of all, turning their hands clockwise or anti-clockwise, for example, to turn a doorknob or a dial up to 11. And he found that this affected the direction they perceived the dots moving in. So the motor system didn't just affect their imaginations, it affected what they saw. And the second big debate after analogy versus proposition is whether we imagine in the same way that we see using the same bits of the brain. And this would count an argument in favour that we do, but most of the time, if you argue that vision and imagery uses the same parts, you're arguing that it's analogical. But Volschlager found that if you planned any movement with a direction in it to move left or right, this affected the way the dots appeared to spin. That there was this idea of a global top-down leftness that affected perception. So Volschlager kind of ends up in the propositional camp, because there's this proposition of left that has nothing to do with the actual thing being rotated. So that top-down concept. Now, I don't like the idea that my perceptions can be influenced by my motor system. Mostly because I think that my motor system has a grudge against my nociceptive or pain perceptor system by constantly walking in me into doors.
Like a pigeon. Interesting, but carry on.
No, I thought it was interesting that you had this feedback, and it still doesn't really give you that many clues as to how the system's working, because its mental imagery is really hard to get at. But I did think it was fascinating that even our perceptions can be affected by what we're imagining.
What you could do is present people with these dot displays and see if having someone else turn their hand one way or the other changes the direction it's going. And so have them hold out their hand and have the experimenter walk up and twist it slightly one way or another.
Ooh.
And then if that actually had an effect, they could still be sort of thinking, oh, look, the experimenter's turning my hand left. I'm thinking of left.
Yeah.
You then flash up the word left on the screen, but have the experimenter turn the hand right and see which one is dominant.
That would be interesting.
Experimental design.
Yeah. Do you want to do that with your life now, Ben, for the next 30
years?
Yeah,
I'll just switch from the entire focus of my DPhil to do one study. I might. I'll ask Nick Young if I should do it. Sorry. Anyway, yeah, so Volschlager and Volschlager, I really like those experiments. And they're really fun to do. We might see if we can find a GIF of the dot displays. It's really cool to see what kind of mental things you can do to change the direction of the rotation. You can do it with your feet, and you can do it with thinking about your feet and all sorts of things. It's kind of fun. Anyway, do I now have your permission to move on to the Flaming Row?
Unleash the Wise.
Unleash the Wise. Okay,
not the
so
wise, wise.
I've prepared this in a particular order, so I'll go through it. Basically, as I was saying before, and as Tim has covered to some extent, there are two main theories of how mental imagery actually works. The first, well, there's not really a first and a second.
How mental imagery actually works is a really terrible sitcom, by the way. They never tell you. It's basically this show.
It's essentially the field of mental imagery is a sitcom where they never tell you how it works because they haven't come to any kind of resolution. Anyway, so the theory that I'm going to talk about first is the propositional theory. This is the idea that when we imagine an object, we activate kind of stored semantic knowledge about its properties. For example, if you're told to imagine a yak, you bring up semantic knowledge that yaks are brown, hairy, and mammalian, maybe. And therefore,
useful mounts.
Yeah. And then when an experimenter asks you, what do you see? We just report what we know we would see were the yak to materialize before us, i.e. a large, brown, hairy, and presumably quite annoyed mammalian quadruped. And so, like, it seems to the experimenter like we're describing the scene as it would be, but it's kind of ambiguous.
That is one of the summon materia that I never found.
It's a good one. For perplexing and surprise value alone. Anyway, the analogy of this is computer graphics. So graphics in a computer game, such as might be Elder Scrolls Skyrim, very good graphics, derive from propositional data, lots of ones and zeros, from which are extracted beautiful vistas and dragons. Now, championing this position is the wonderfully named Zenon Polishin, Zenon Polishin.
As in the noble gas.
Well, he shares his first name not only with the noble gas, but also a Seleucid general and a Korean encryption algorithm, amongst about 12 different awesome things. He actually spells his first name Zenon rather than Xenon, which I think makes it about 3% more awesome.
Like Greek sentence. I don't know. I think using X's as a proper like starting consonant is just epic.
It is kind of ballsy. Anyway, so his Zenon Polishin. Zenon is exciting for reasons that I just mentioned. Polishin, his surname, is exciting because it has no vowels except...
It's an amazing vowel-less surname!
So it's spelled P-Y-L-Y-S-H-Y-N, and therefore scores a mighty 22 in Scrabble, largely thanks to its three Y's. Now, this excitingly means that an ancestor of Polishin's was presumably present at the birth of Christ. You know, one of the three wise men?
Oh, Ben, we should start a Christmas cracker business. It's too early to be talking about Christmas.
I was unduly proud of that one, and I like the fact that you're laughing, could have been crying for a while.
Well, yeah, I think... You know when you do something really terrible and part of you is kind of proud?
Yes.
You know.
Yes, exactly. Anyway, so that's the propositional view, that we don't experience mental imagery as images, so to speak. They are simply extrapolations from propositional statements, and it is championed by Zenon Polishin in the propositional corner. Now, the other main competing theory is, I'm going to call it the pictorial theory, but it kind of derives from the analogical position. And this is kind of more simply that when you conjure up a mental image, the vision areas of your brain are reactivated in exactly the same pattern as if you were seeing the object in real life. So when you describe the mental image, you are in essence looking with your mind's eye and describing what you see.
The signal's a bit weaker or something, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of neuroimaging and neurological work that's gone on to this, because obviously the hypothesis of this is relatively easy to test. If you're saying the vision areas are involved in mental imagery, then you get people to conjure mental images and look at their visual cortex. And indeed, the vast majority of visual cortical areas involved in normal vision are also activated when you to kind of internally generate mental images, but it's not exactly the same. I'm not going to go into the details of which bits are and aren't involved, partly because it's not massively funny and partly because I haven't learnt it. Because
well, yeah, I think I saw Coslin say it's like, oh, it's 2/3 the same and 1/3 different. It's like, well, that's a nice round number.
So, yeah.
The What's Coslin's first name, by the way?
Alas, it is merely Stephen.
Zenon versus Steve.
Hello, I'm Steve.
Well, it'd be better if they were the other way around, if like Coslin spoke with a booming, echoing, stentorian voice, and so like, hello, I'm Stephen Coslin, and Politian was, hello, I'm Zenon.
Steve Coslin! To do an Arrested Development reference.
Anyway, yes, yeah, so the pictorial theory is number two, and this, the analogy of this is a cinema projector where you're deriving images from other images, essentially. So there's a bunch of evidence for both these positions. Tim's talked about some of the evidence and the fact that, you know, very subtle adjustments in how you do your experiment or how you interpret your data can make quite a big difference as to which theory your evidence supports. So the Wolfschläger stuff, just changing whether you actually physically turn your hand or whether you just think about turning your hand completely changes the interpretation in light of these two theories. Possibly because these theories are so kind of close and there's such a narrow separation between them, they, as I mentioned earlier, preemptively have become a massive fighting ground. We need a kind of a psychoanalyst whose name begins with B, because I wanted to say a B asterisk CH fest, because that's what it is. It's literally a mudslinging match. The argument's been going on for about 15 years, if not more, and shows no real sign of slowing down, mainly because neither side is prepared to concede the fact that they haven't won yet.
And probably won't.
So, yeah, I mean, there's evidence for both sides. For example, there's behavioral evidence for this, the pictorial view, something called visual imagery overflow, which, once again, you can do if you're at home and want to do some visual imagining. So imagine an elephant. Now imagine approaching the elephant carefully. You don't want to hurt yourself. Don't want to startle it. Approach the elephant until the boundaries of the elephant, presumably its trunk and its tail, if you're imagining it side on, as all right thinking people should, approach the elephant until the boundaries you're close enough so that they are outside of your visual field, so you've approached close enough that you can't see all the elephant at once. Now tell,
practically breathing the elephant in at this point.
You
are
very
close to it.
Okay, so you're quite close to it. How far away would you say you were, rough estimation?
Less than a foot, somewhere like about 9 inches.
Okay, that I probably should have looked
have
up.
Have I disproven the theory?
Well, I don't know. So the idea is that people are actually remarkably accurate at saying what the actual distance would be,
okay,
if you were approaching an elephant.
I found it very hard to keep stable. It kept resetting to the start of the scene where I was walking up to the elephant. I can tell you, I was at about 7:30 in terms of the elephant's o'clocks.
Okay. well, that's utterly inconclusive evidence. But anyway, so this is, Coslin claims that this is the thing. So you have this behavioral evidence, and also all the stuff we were talking about with mental rotation adhering to, you know, physical properties and stuff that we're used to seeing. You also, as I mentioned before, get the neurological evidence that most areas of the visual cortex that are active in mental imagery tasks are, you know, the same as the ones in normal seeing. And there's also this idea.
I find the neurophys quite convincing.
It is convincing. And there's this second point about it, that the occipital lobe, which is the one at the back where vision happens, the structure of the brain areas there are often arranged in what's called topographic maps. And this is the idea that you have a population of cells whose activation maps directly onto how, say, images appear in space. So, for example, if you have two dots that are like next to each other and you're looking at them, the cells in some areas of visual cortex that respond to those two dots will also be next to each other within their little topographic map area. So the idea is that, you know, the physical world as you perceive it is represented kind of physically in the brain. This is very similar to what we were talking about previously about in the Ramachandran episode on Phantom Limb, when you have a topographic map kind of your touch sensations with the little homunculus.
Yeah.
Except in vision, it doesn't have the weird inconsistencies that the tactile homunculus.
No, does it have one of those helpful terms like semi-topographic?
I don't. I imagine.
I seem to remember it's like, and then there's some bits that are not topographic but are spatially mapped or something. I can't remember. It's very confusing. Is it worth me mentioning the magical island of Coslin at this point?
Well, yes, because so there are those are evidence very much for the pictorial or the analogical position, but there are studies and evidence and kind of anecdotal suggestions as to why this isn't the case, one of which are some map studies.
Yeah, so basically what Coslin did in his long attempt to defeat Palitian, this is from 1978 that Coslin did this, and they're still arguing, you know, as far as you said, Ben, this day.
As far as I know.
I mean, I think it's at least until, like, the first decade of the 21st century.
Yes.
So, you know, very recently. I wonder if it's like Zients and Lazarus, and one of them has kind of lost, if only because the other one died.
I don't know. I mean, there was an article in Scientific American Mind, apparently, in 2006, which was kind of a summary of the debate as it still rages.
Right. Well, Coslin showed participants a map of an island and had them study it and draw it from memory until they really had a clear mental image of this map of an island. And then he showed them words referring to different landmarks that he'd drawn on the island, like the well and that sort of thing. I'll try and find a copy of it if possible, because it's quite a cute little thing, really. Would say, okay, have you, like, imagine in your head, you travel from the well to the dock and see how long it took. And they'd know, obviously, the distance on the map between those places, and they found that it showed a linear curve. But Palitian was just like, this is ridiculous. And so he made a wall-based version of the map where each of these locations had a light. And when you press the button for each location, the light came on at that location. So, you know, if you press the button for the dock and previously the button for the well had been pressed, the light instantly moved from the speed of light. And so he then got them to imagine in their heads that they were looking at Palitian's, you know, light-based map and pressing the button. And, of course, took no time at all in their heads for them to move from well to dock. So basically, although you could argue, well, that's analogical, because it's an analogical to a thing that they've seen. Palitian's point is there's no linear delay for distance. And Coslin's arguing in order to move from one place to another, you have to transition in your head. And Palitian's like, well, actually, no, you don't. You just have to think dock. And from Palitian's point of view, the idea of dock takes you to the place of dock. You don't need to go, oh, Doc, that's 10 miles from the well. I have to travel mental 10 miles.
I actually have a picture, possibly not exactly the same, but an article that Palitian wrote, which has a version of this map in it. And the objects on it are slightly peculiar and slightly spooky in one case. So there's a tree, a lighthouse and a beach, as you might expect. There's a ship out in the sea. There's an arch, which looks a little bit like the Arc de Triomphe in Paris, right, but then most arches do. There's a tower, which is, I think, is meant to be like a pylon type thing. And then an elephant, which I would claim is not a particularly good object to have on an island, given the potential for it to move around.
Is it just a dig at Coslin talking about elephants?
It could be, actually. I wouldn't put it past Palitian. Anyway, so there are studies like that which show that perhaps mental imagery doesn't always follow physical properties, and it doesn't involve conjuring an actual image. There's also sort of anecdotal things like people find it very difficult or impossible to imagine illusions. So if any of you know what the Necker cube is, this is kind of a physics defying line drawing of a cube. Where, or not a line drawing, but a drawing of a cube whereby the like angles of it cross over in kind of M.C. Escher-esque way. Apparently, people have great difficulty actually conjuring a visual image of the Necker Cube. Picture to follow in the show notes, possibly. So the way that obviously there is evidence for the pictorial view as well. So what Polition says he reckons is happening is that when participants are asked by an experimenter to conjure up a mental image, they unconsciously realize that the task requires like a simulation of visual processing, and then they behave accordingly, kind of unconsciously imposing reaction times on themselves that are consistent with, you know, the pictorial view. So these are kind of the basic positions of the debate. I'm not going to go into all the intricate details because there have been a lot of them. And one of the I suppose, positive things about this is that this rivalry between Polition and Coslin, and it is definitely a rivalry, as you'll see in a minute, has produced a ridiculously large number of papers and a lot of very interesting research on the stuff. And has, at least in Coslin's case, got him like a very, very swanky research grant and a team and a lab.
What do people not like Polition? I hear Polition is quite hard to get on with in real life.
It wouldn't necessarily surprise me.
But why should Coslin be any better?
Well, this is the thing. You know, in these debates, you're always trying to work out why it is that it's gone on this long. Polition does come across as being a very kind of combative and stick-in-the-mud type personality in terms of the fact that he really refuses to kind of withdraw or move on. Coslin has spent a lot of time, you know, he's kind of in the past 5 or 6 or 7 years, I guess, actually started sort of expanding upon his theory and trying to work out how it works, you know, at a neurological level and all this kind of thing. Whereas Polition basically continues to churn out articles just criticizing the theory over and over again along the same lines. For example, and to give you an idea of the level at which this debate is kind of working, in one article entitled Return of the Mental Image, Are There Really Pictures in the Brain? By Polition, he called Coslin's theory that you have sort of visual reactivation in the visual cortex, he called it grotesque.
I don't even see how it can be grotesque.
Well, it's interesting.
What's the danger of Coslin being right?
I found the point in the actual article where he says this, and it's under the heading, Has Neuroscience Resolved the Imagery Debate? And the paragraph goes as follows. Recently, there have been claims that neuroscience evidence support what would otherwise be a grotesque proposal, that to have a mental image is to project a two-dimensional moving picture onto the surface of your visual cortex. Now, that would be quite grotesque, but it's also completely wrong. That is in no way what the neuroscience, you know, proponents of the pictorial view are suggesting. And it's that sort of slight disinclination to actually take on the facts themselves. Unfortunately, it isn't entirely one-sided.
No.
Because Coslin's response to this was to publish a paper called Against the Nihilistic Hypothesis, in which he calls Polition's kind of theory scientifically nihilistic. He's kind of trying to kind of drive the scientific method into the ground. Slightly weirdly, one or other of these people seems to have time-travelled in the publication of these two articles, because Coslin's response to Polition was published in 2002. The article where Polition calls Coslin's theory grotesque was published in 2003. So
do you reckon that he saw a pre-release version and that they sent it to each other?
It could be. It could be that the journals themselves were maybe trying to stir this up and so sent the things back and forth, or that they're just slow to publish.
You know, because it has to be peer-reviewed. And because they're in the same field, I guess Coslin and Polition are always each other's peers when it comes to the review.
Probably quite likely. But, you know, I do like to think that Polition actually like has access to a time machine. So he went back in time, cancelled the publication of his article, so he claimed to be the victim. Obviously, though, that would prevent Coslin from having originally cited him. So Polition would have created a paradox, which presumably would tear apart the very fabric of time and space. Mm-hmm. But I suspect in this instance, the Politician would still claim the moral high ground.
Can I just read the end, unless you want to, the very end of Against the Nihilistic Hypothesis?
Go for it.
The closing parts of Politician's article offer a clear choice. One can attempt to work out a scientific theory which guides empirical research and leads to new discoveries, as has the depictive theory of visual images, or one can argue that such efforts are a dead end and speculate that imagery is an ineffable phenomenon that cannot be illuminated by scientific research. We leave the choice up to the reader. It's like, no, you don't. You leave the choice up to the very loaded way in which you put that.
I mean, it's wonderful. You could give these articles to, like, a GCSE critical thinking class as like gratuitous examples of like straw man arguments and all this kind of thing. But we kind of love, I kind of love them for it. I think it's great. And there is a very good point to be made. There's a key point to be made about this, that whilst the debate does still rage and they haven't, neither side has admitted that the other side is right. Over the course of the time that they've been having this rivalry, they have produced an inordinate number of studies and done an awful lot of very good research trying to kind of kick the other in the nuts, essentially. And this is can only be a good thing for our like the general public and the non-invested public's understanding of mental imagery. And I guess the conclusion as to which is right, propositional or pictorial, is kind of like, it depends, as with so many of these things.
Well, yes, there's some evidence that actually proves this, isn't there, Ben?
Well, yeah, so the final thing I'd like to talk about this week is the fact that one of the interesting things about mental imagery is that it like not everyone seems to experience it the same way. So some people experience extremely vivid mental imagery and, you know, can describe things in explicit detail, the mental images that they're very easily able to conjure. Some people don't appear to have it almost at all. There was a guy called, I think it's Francis Galton.
Good old Galton.
In the 1800s, who wrote a paper called The Statistics of Mental Imagery, in which he went around his distinguished scientific colleagues and asked them if they, you know, questions about how they experience mental imagery. And he was surprised by the fact that almost none of them, in his words, actually experienced it at all, which was interesting. What is slightly suspicious about this is perhaps that Galton based most of his kind of arguments on, apparently, one or two of those of his bestest buddies in the scientific community, who may just have been, you know, the kind of people who didn't experience very much mental imagery, and then kind of extrapolated wildly from there.
However, well, Galton, I think, is the guy who invented eugenics, so he's not the world's greatest scientist.
Anyway, what this does is raise the interesting question of maybe part of the reason that this debate has become so entrenched is because the proponents of each side genuinely experience a different form of mental imagery, or maybe some of them don't really experience it at all. You can quite understand that. I wish I could find the quote from Galton where he's talking about the response that he got from one of these scientists who's like, I don't understand what you mean by mental imagery. When I'm asked to recall an object or a situation, the process of recall is one of kind of statements and semantic knowledge about it, nothing to do with images. And I mean, that's kind of exactly in line with...
He says, it is only by a figure of speech that I can describe my recollection of a scene as a mental image, which I can see with my mind's eye. I do not see it any more than a man sees the thousand lines of Sophocles, which under due pressure he is ready to repeat. The memory possesses it, etc.
Which, of course, is interesting when you consider that some people, when asked to recall the thousand lines of Sophocles or whatever, do actually see the page in front of them.
Yeah, exactly.
So this is the perfect example of perhaps this is part of the problem, and maybe Politian doesn't have much mental imagery, and maybe Coslin really does, and this is an issue. What's really cool is that someone actually took it upon themselves to study this kind of experimentally. It's a guy called Riceberg as the primary author. Interestingly enough, the full citation is Riceberg, Pearson, and guess who? Coslin.
Oh, I didn't realise that.
Published in 2003, and what it's called intuitions and introspections about imagery, that is hard to say, the role of imagery experience in shaping an investigator's theoretical views. So this is based upon the idea that your predispositions about your own experiences with mental imagery will not only colour kind of what side of the debate you come down on, but could actually impact on your experimental findings, as in the outcomes of experiments you might run. So basically what they did was they got a bunch of grad students who needed to run studies and kind of gave them all the same brief to run a study in which they were testing mental imagery and seeing if it existed. And basically they told half of them that mental imagery was a genuine thing and the other half of them that it was probably not. And the results exactly divided down that midline. The people, the students who'd been told that mental imagery was a genuine thing found that mental imagery was a genuine thing. The ones that had been told that it wasn't found that it wasn't. Which could very well explain a lot of the data that has come out of both sides of the argument, frankly. You know, one of the problems with mental imagery is it's a lot of people find it quite difficult, and it's not something you're particularly used to having someone tell you to conjure a mental image. And so experimenter bias and the way that the experimenter presents the question to you can potentially, as Riseberg proves, really bias the way it turns out. Doesn't entirely explain why Polition and Coslin are so impolite towards each other in print, but we'll just thank them for that because it makes it more funny to read.
I'm sure they have some strong feelings for each other, really.
Well, yes, there was this article that I was reading in preparation for this that's kind of discussing why it's lasted so long. He does point out at one point that Polition mentions Coslin about twice as much in his articles as Coslin mentions Polition, which it presents perhaps a slightly sad picture.
Oh,
it's just kind of like begging for attention whilst being ignored. A bit like us with this podcast, really. but he also says, you know, in this instance, what this shows is that in some cases, a rivalry can be just as productive as a collaboration, which is a nice positive spin on the whole thing, and definitely not, it's neither nihilistic nor grotesque.
Yeah, clearly I need to find an arc nemesis to do a podcast with.
Well, yeah,
what This Is Not My Nickname says, you know, we are friends and companions.
We haven't got a nemesis for the podcast yet. I was thinking maybe it should be Psychomedia, the Italian or Spanish media company that keeps stealing all our domain names that we want.
They were made long time before us.
I know. That doesn't mean we can't still hate them.
Okay. Yeah, not really going to lead to that much. Like, we don't compete in the same fields. We can't make that videos that easily, and they don't seem to do psychology podcasts yet.
If they do, oh, it's so on.
Whereas I was thinking we should try and find some kind of comedy podcast, like if there's a sociology or a philosophy one. We can have beef. And now I want beef.
Beef would be good. I'm kind of hungry. And on that note, we should probably end the podcast.
Yeah, I mean, we've basically concluded, is mental imagery this way or that way? Well, actually, it depends on the way you see it with your mind's eye.
No, in this way, back, way forward and backwards over the imagery. Da-dum-de-dum.
Oh, I forgot to do the bit. You know, there was a kids' TV show called something like Salty's Island, and whenever I think of Coslin's Island, it's just like Coslin's Island from the theme song of that.
Ending on singing as we began, although you don't know that we began on it because... anyway,
yeah,
what was that joke that I made? Oh yeah, it was my mind's got no nose, how does it smell, with propositional statements. It's funny. Objectively funny.
Oh, we could be Lee instead of Herring. And, you know, my mind has no nose, and how does it smell? Well, it smells, how does it smell? That's basically Stuart Lee, right?
Right, I see.
If we get done for libel because we insulted a guy's comedy style and not their science.
I don't think we'd get done because he presumably has so much more ammunition if he wishes to insult our comedy style.
Yeah, he has a BBC Two show, we don't. Mm. He does have a hate mail ticker that goes across his website, though. Ah. I could send this bit in.
That would be, maybe we found our beef.
Lee and Herring, we're calling you out.
Right. Well, on that extremely nihilistic note, we should end the podcast. As always, feedback, muchly appreciated. Do come pester me on this weird newfangled Twitter thing at Team Psychomedia. It is essentially an outlet for me being annoyed at having to do work these days, but that's fine.
That's basically what Twitter was designed for.
Occasionally mention things relevant to the podcast.
Yep.
And email at psychomediapodcast@gmail.com.
I'm still Timothy Swan on Facebook, for example, and I'm at Tetrarchangel on Twitter. Tetrarchangel.tumblr.com. I even have an ask box if you did want to talk to me in that stupid, stupid way. But until next time, let's say goodbye.
Goodbye.
Imagine a world of beautiful crystal spires, of evidence that stands up to scrutiny but still makes you laugh. We're building that place today for tomorrow. The world of tomorrow, today, opens January. A utopia of psychomedia, an international community of the mind, literally in your mind. Glistening spheres of glorious light, spinning around and around for all time at a set speed. A world of rules ordained by physics. Come and join us with your mind's nose, your mind's tongue, and your mind's clavicle.